Jewish audio on Kabbat.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our course on Jewish history. And this evening we are going to learn about the destruction of the First Temple and the Babylonian exile. Now we're going to start this evening with three very important dates, all of which you are familiar with. The first date is the 10th of the month of Teves in the year 3336. The second date is the 17th of Tammuz in the year 3338. And the third date is the 9th of Av in the year 3338. So 3338 is an important number to remember, because it was in that year that there was the destruction of the First Temple. Now, as you know, the 10th of Teves was, and all these are national fast days, the 10th of Teves, Asara B'Teves, is the day that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, started the siege of Jerusalem. On the 17th of Tammuz, 2 years later, the walls of Jerusalem were breached, and the 9th of Av, of course, was the day of destruction of the First Temple. What is amazing about the 9th of Av is that it is reoccurring in our history. The first day of Jewish calamity, Jewish national calamity, the first day was in fact the day when the spies in the desert were sent by Moses to spy out the land, and they came back with a negative report, and the people cried that night when they came back and said, "We can't go into the land. It's too difficult. It's too great for him," meaning for the Almighty, "even to take us in there." And the people cried. God said, "You cried for nothing. I will make you cry for something." And that date was the day that was fixed as the destruction of the First Temple, the Second Temple. It was the day that the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. It's the day that the First World War started. A number of other calamities happened on the 9th of Av. The class this evening is going to span to the year 3408, which in fact was the year that construction was begun on the Second Temple, the arrival of a man called Ezra, about whom we shall learn in 3413, and Nehemiah, his partner in the reconstruction, in the year 3426. If you subtract 3336, the day that Nebuchadnezzar besieged the temple, till the arrival of Nehemiah in Israel, it is in fact a period of 90 years. So our class this evening is going to span a period in Jewish history of 90 years, which is relatively small compared to the last 2 weeks, in which we have in fact studied the period of the kingdoms of Judah and Ephraim, spanning nearly 400 years of history, from the beginning of the building of the First Temple until its destruction. But it is an important 90 years. And the reason is, as we will remember, Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, had already exiled the kingdom of Ephraim, the 10 tribes of Israel that lived in the northern kingdom. Over 100 years had been exiled and really never to return. The small kingdom of Judah was left, and this was the remnant of the Jewish people that had entered the land with Joshua. And when they were exiled, they went to Babylon. And yet, although physically they were exiled, spiritually the yearning for a return to their homeland burned strongly in their hearts. And they did return. So tonight is a story of destruction, exile, and return. Let us start this evening with the bubbling pot. Do you know what I'm referring to? Jeremiah, the great Jewish prophet. His book opens with a vision of a bubbling pot with its froth to the north. And this was a pictorial vision of the bubbling, if you want, disintegration of the kingdom of Judah, and its froth, its wrath, was from the north, meaning that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, was to march down from the north, going in a southerly direction to destroy Jerusalem. His second vision, also in the book, was that of an almond stick. Now, an almond ripens in 21 days. It's the quickest fruit to blossom and to ripen. Those who will remember that when there was a contest in the Bible between Aaron and others who, and the other tribes, as to whom was to have the title of the priesthood, Moses placed a stick from each tribe inside the Holy of Holies, and it was Aaron's rod that blossomed, and it blossomed into almonds. Now, an almond takes 21 days to blossom. Jeremiah interpreted that to mean that it would take 21 days from the breach of the wall until the destruction, and that is exactly what happened. The wall of Jerusalem was breached by Nebuchadnezzar on 17th of Tammuz, exactly 3 weeks later, on the 9th of Av, the temple was destroyed. And, in fact, forevermore, these 3 weeks have come to be known as the three-week period, which in fact are in the summer, where there are, even today, laws of Avilut, of mourning, which we observe, particularly in the 9 days, the days from Rosh Chodesh Av until the 9th of Av, where it's the custom in many communities not to eat meat during those 9 days, for example, as a sign of our mourning. Jeremiah himself was thrown into prison because of his woeful prophecies. In fact, the king, the last king of Judah, was called Zedekiah. And it was in the 11th year of his reign, on the 17th of Tammuz, after a long siege, that the walls were breached. The king Zedekiah fled through a subterranean passage, and he was, however, captured in the plains of Jericho. He was brought before the mighty Nebuchadnezzar in a place called Rivla. Many of the greatest Jews of the generation was slain before his own eyes, including his own family. His own eyes were put out, and he, Zedekiah, was led in chains to Babylon. On the 7th of Av, Nebuchadnezzar's chief general, he was a man called Nebuzaradan, he began the destruction of Yerushalayim, taking it apart, taking the walls apart, taking the entire structure apart, and on the evening, towards the evening of the 9th of Av, set the temple on fire. All the gold and silver, of course, was looted. The artifacts of the temple were taken away by Nebuchadnezzar. What is fascinating, though, and I'd like to stress this point, is the following. And my source for saying this is Maimonides, who is quoting from a part of the Talmud. What happened to the Holy Ark? Now, you know that Moses, before he died, wrote a Sefer Torah, and he placed it inside the Ark, which was placed inside the Holy of Holies. Inside the Ark as well were the tablets of stone which Moses brought down from the mountain, the second set of tablets, the unbroken set of tablets. Now, what happened to this ark? Because, as you will know, there's great speculation as to where this ark ended up. Many people think it's in this little temple in Ethiopia, guarded by some strange monk, or and I'm not sure what his real title is over there, but where did it in fact end up? Maimonides, quoting from the Talmud, says the following. King Solomon, when he built the first temple, knew, or was divinely inspired, knew that it was to be destroyed. It was not going to last forever. And he left in his will and testament that if destruction was imminent, the king at the time should entomb the artifacts of the temple in subterranean catacombs underneath the Temple Mount, which were constructed by Solomon at the time. Zedekiah, the last king, did exactly that. The ark, the staff of Aaron, the jar of manna. Do you remember that when the manna fell in the wilderness, God commanded Moses that some of the manna be put in a tzinzenet, in a jar, which was to be kept for posterity to show all generations that this was the stuff that the Almighty sustained the Jews in the wilderness with. That, together with the staff of Aaron, together with the holy ark, was entombed underneath the Temple Mount. So, it is the authentic Jewish tradition that if today we would excavate underneath the Temple Mount, in addition to sparking off World War III, we would find the Ark and the Sefer Torah. And please God, when Mashiach comes, those will be brought out. Now, of course, this means that when the second temple was built, there was no Ark inside the Holy of Holies. If so, you can ask, what was there? And the answer is nothing, apart from the stone upon which, it is the tradition, that was the place that Abraham bound Isaac. This is the place where all the great things, Jacob prayed and so on and so forth, that was a holy place. But the actual ark was not there in the second temple. Where is it? So it is Jewish tradition that it is entombed underneath the Temple Mount and is still there today. Nebuzaradan was a great murderer. The entire account, of course, is told in great length of the destruction in various books. Of course, the great lament over the destruction of the temple is told beautifully by Jeremiah himself, who lived through the destruction. In fact, he was, as I mentioned before, and placed in prison because of his woeful prophecies and barely sustained. Nebuchadnezzar ordered his release, and in fact he was given the choice as to whether he wished to remain to stay in Israel or go with the exiles. And although we don't know exactly where he is buried, it is believed that Jeremiah went eventually, although he stayed a certain time in Israel, as we'll see soon, eventually he went to Babylon, and it is there that he died. Many priests were slain. In the Book of Lamentations of Echa, which Jeremiah wrote, it's told very clearly the great suffering of the destruction. And even today, on Tisha B'Av, on the 9th of Av, the Book of Echa is read in the synagogue. We sit on low stools, we read it in a very mournful but moving tune, and it starts off with the words, Echa Yoshva Vodod, alas, or woe, she sits alone. And of course laments the great fact that how great the mighty have fallen, and ends off with the words, Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha V'noshuva, we implore the Almighty to return us to Him, Chadesh Yomeinu Kekedem, renewal, renew our days as the days of old. At the end of the destruction of the temple, as we shall soon see, the people felt the full impact of their sins. It was understood that the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem was a culmination, a venting of the Almighty's anger over the idolatrous situation in Israel at the time. And in fact, the Talmud, interestingly enough, asks, why was the first temple destroyed? And it says, because the Jews had transgressed the three cardinal sins of idolatry, murder, and immorality. Whereas, for example, the second temple, it says that the temple was destroyed because of sinas chinam, of baseless hatred. What is fascinating also about Jewish history, I've mentioned this a few times, and we can now draw this entire subject to a close because it does not reoccur again in Jewish history, is the subject of idolatry. The rabbis point out in the Talmud that our desire to bow down to an effigy, an idol, has disappeared. Nobody in this room has a remote desire to bow down to an idol. It just doesn't, it's ridiculous. The whole notion is ridiculous to us. Or to worship the sun and the moon, to us here, it is a foreign idea. Then, there was a passionate desire to do so. There is a story in the Talmud that Menasseh, one of the kings of Judah, in fact appeared to one of the sages of the Talmud in a dream, and this sage said to him, how could you serve the Baal? How could you serve the idol? And Menasseh said to him, had you been there, you would have lifted the hem of your skirt up. Apparently the rabbis then used to wear long kaftans, and you would have ran after it. In other words, the impulse, the desire was very strong. However, after the destruction of the first temple, that desire was removed from the Jewish people. And thereafter, although they weren't exactly moral, there was always there were always breaches in our morals. However, we never went back to idolatry. And quite on the contrary, Jews throughout the ages were well known to be able, and did in fact, give up their lives for their belief in monotheism. So that is an interesting point, and I think the reason is because when the first temple was destroyed, and they had had so many warnings by the prophets that it's because of this reason that the temple is going to be destroyed, I think they got the message and it was eradicated. Another point, the Jews also felt that the Toichacha, the admonitions of Moses, had been fulfilled. Moses had in fact told the people that if you do not serve the Almighty God, you will be banished from your land. And the first destruction was the realization of this. They saw the truth in the admonitions of the Torah and clung to it in their exile. Nebuchadnezzar did not totally destroy the Yishuv. He left its poorest residents. And he appointed a good man, a man called Gedaliah ben Achikam, to be its governor. Gedaliah was a wise man, and after the destruction, he tried to reorganize the remnants as best as he could. In fact, Yirmiah, the prophet, Jeremiah, went to a town which is north of Jerusalem called Mitzpah, and together with Gedaliah, Mitzpah became the spiritual center. Jerusalem had, of course, been reduced to ruins. Mitzpah became the spiritual center for the poor people who were left. Gedaliah, as I said, was a good man, he was wise, and he started to lay the foundations for economic prosperity in the area, and he did a phenomenal job in a very short time. The Jews had suffered the worst blow that they'd ever suffered, and yet were quite resilient. The small community under the leadership of Gedaliah ben Achikam, in fact, flourished. Not only that, it was protected by the Babylonian garrison that Nebuchadnezzar had left when he departed. He left a garrison in the land of Israel, and they were protected. However, that too was not to last. Treachery came in the form of a man called Yishmael ben Nethaniah. He was a descendant of the royal house of Zedekiah, and he was filled with jealousy over the success of Gedaliah ben Achikam. He found an ally in a neighboring king. It was called the king of Ammon, and Ammon, of course, the next door king, was also worried about this, the prospects of this small yishuv growing and be so successful that it in fact would affect him. And what Yishmael did was, on Rosh Hashanah, when all the nobles and all the great people that were left were assembled in Mitzpah around Gedaliah, although in fact Gedaliah had been warned by his men that his life was in danger, and he was in fact threatened by Yishmael ben Nethaniah, that didn't deter him from inviting him to the Rosh Hashanah feast. And it was on the very day of Rosh Hashanah that Yishmael ben Nethaniah murdered Gedaliah ben Achikam in Mitzpah. And he ran. Yishmael ran to the king of Ammon to find, to escape. Not only did he murder Gedaliah, he also put to death the Babylonian garrison that was in that was protecting him. It was around Gedaliah. And of course the Jews that were left were extremely afraid. What would Nebuchadnezzar say when his governor, whom he had appointed, Gedaliah ben Achikam, and his own garrison of men were murdered by an upstart? The people were very afraid. They thought, what should we do? What should we do? They knew that Nebuchadnezzar would send an army and in fact crush them, annihilate them. They felt that there was only one escape route. An escape route that they didn't want to go, but apparently was the only way out. And that was to return to Egypt. 900 years ago or so, they'd come out, and now perhaps they should go back. They went to Yirmiah, they went to Jeremiah himself, to ask the prophet, should they return? Of course, it's so difficult for Yirmiah. He'd been through the warnings, he'd warned the people, he'd lived through the destruction, and now they want to abandon the land and go back to Egypt. Jeremiah fasted for he prayed to God for 10 days, and then he received a divine message, which he told the people, which reads like this. Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, if you will still dwell in this land, I will build you and not destroy you, and I will plant you and not pluck you up. Fear not the king of Babylon, of whom you are afraid, for I am with you to save you. But if you say, we will not dwell in this land, disobeying the voice of the Lord your God, saying, no, but we will go into the land of Egypt, then it shall come to pass that the sword which you feared shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine whereof you were afraid shall follow close after you in Egypt, and there you shall die. The Lord has spoken to you, O remnant of Judah, go not to Egypt. Know you with certainty, for I have warned you this day. Sadly, Jeremiah's words fell on deaf ears. The people had already decided that they wanted to go to Egypt. They just wanted him to give the okay. He didn't. He warned them yet again, and they did not listen. In fact, they forced Jeremiah himself to come with them to Egypt. And as Jeremiah had prophesied, only a few years later, although they'd temporarily found a safe haven, however, there was a coup in Egypt. The pharaoh was assassinated. The Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar felt, right, this is a good time to march against the land. He invaded, he swept again down, he came through the Holy Land, he invaded Egypt, and the result was that he killed the remaining Jewish refugees. And Jeremiah's far prophecy was fulfilled. There were no Jews in the land of Israel, and now the Jews who had fled to Egypt were also killed, or died in famine as he had prophesied. Jeremiah himself was saved, and I said beforehand, it is with his student, a man called Baruch ben Neriah, that Jeremiah went to live his last years in Babylon. Again, it is on the 3rd of Tishrei that we have another fast day. The day after Rosh Hashanah, I said to you before that Gedaliah was in fact killed on Rosh Hashanah, but on Rosh Hashanah you can't proclaim a fast day, and therefore the day after Rosh Hashanah we have a Tzom Gedaliah. We have a fast of Gedaliah. So it's interesting to know that the five national Jewish fast days are of course all instituted around the destruction of the temple. You've got the 10th of Tevis, which was the beginning of the siege, the 17th of Tam was the breaching of the walls, the 9th of Av, the destruction, the 3rd of Tishrei, the murder of Gedaliah ben Achikam, which was in fact the final nail in the coffin. He was the last hope. Had he not been murdered, then who knows? It may have flourished, but that was not to be. And one more fast day, in fact, which we'll get to soon, the fast of Esther, which also comes in this period, as we'll soon see. I'd like to mention a certain lady over here, a forgotten lady, but one who didn't forget about us. Cast your minds way back over here, to biblical times, even before Moses' days, in the days of Jacob. Jacob had two wives, Rachel and Leah. Leah, he buried in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. He buried in the tomb in Hebron. Of course, it's called Machpelah because it comes from the word Kephel, which means double. It's the cave of doubles. Adam and Eve are buried there. Abraham and Sarah are buried there. Isaac and Rebekah are buried there. Jacob and Leah are buried there. Who's missing? Rachel. Rachel. It says that he buried her on the way. He buried her on the way. And today, I'm sure many of you have visited Kever Rachel, the tomb of Rachel. Now, do you remember when Jacob went down to Egypt to see his son Joseph? He was still alive. And of course, that was the descent of Jacob and his 70 family members to Egypt, which was the beginning of the descent of the Jews to Egypt. When Jacob is on his deathbed, he calls his son Joseph over to him, and he says, Joseph, my last request, when I die, don't bury me here. Carry me to the land of Israel and bury me in Hebron, in the cave of HaMachpelah. And then he said to him the following words, and don't be annoyed at me that I buried your mother on the way. In other words, Jacob was telling his son Joseph, I'm asking you to do me a favor to carry me all the way from Egypt to Israel to bury me, and yet you may ask in the back of your mind, in the deep recesses of your heart, and you, Daddy, you couldn't have buried my mummy. You couldn't have carried her another few miles and buried her with everybody else. And there is a beautiful Rashi over there who quotes the Medrash, who says the following. Jacob then knew, he was divinely inspired, that one day his naughty children would be exiled, and that they would pass through that area where Rachel had died. And he buried them there on the way because he knew that the exiles would go through that area on their way to Babylon. And he wanted, and Rachel wanted, that she should pray for them that they should return. And there is a beautiful verse which goes, Koil Brahma Nishma. There was a voice heard above, and it was crying, and it was crying for her children, and a heavenly voice replied, you will be rewarded for your prayers, because the children will return. And this is a very moving episode, and I bring it in here because this is the very essence of a Jewish mother, one whom is willing to give up on not being buried with all the great saints. She's willing not to be in the limelight. She's willing to be in the back stage. For what? To pray for a child, not a good child, a naughty child, a child who had erred, a child who had sinned, and yet it was still her children, and she wanted them to come back. This was Rachel, and that was why Rachel was buried on the way. The exiles passed through that area, she prayed for them, and they did in fact return, as we will soon learn. Now, I must, at this point, also remind you that 11 years prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar had in fact already exiled a number of Jews to Babylon. If you remember, in fact, 11 years before Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, he'd already marched there once, and the Jews had agreed to become or pay tribute to him. It was only later, when they decided to ally with Egypt and others, that they distanced him, and of course he came and crushed them. But there was in fact a first exile 11 years prior to the destruction of the temple, and I'm going to refer to that from now on as the first captivity. Okay, so when I say the first captivity, I'm referring to a number of Jews who were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar 11 years prior to the destruction of the temple. And the people whom he took 11 years prior to the destruction were all great nobles and skilled workers. In fact, he drained the top mines. He did some, professional picking. You got headhunting. He did some headhunting, and he took a whole load of professional skilled workers and noblemen and princes to enrich his own coffers and to build his own palace and to fashion beautiful vessels for him and so on and so forth. This was in fact in the times of Jehoiachin. When he brought these Jews in the first captivity to Babylon, the Jews built communities, and in fact they gained some prominence in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. These Jews, when they heard of the destruction of the temple, they understood that the warnings of the prophets had become true, and it was their sins that had destroyed the land. They saw Babylon as a strange land, and it is there, when they reached, that they in fact sat down and wept. And we must of course quote here the famous psalm, Al Nares Bovel, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. And of course the famous quote, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand fail. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, tishkach yemini. A member of the nobility, a Kohen, a man called Yechezkel ben Buzi, was one of those people who was taken in the first captivity. When he got to Bavel, the Jews, as I said, gained prominence in the palace, and it was prior to the destruction. Okay, there was a king still in Israel. Everything was under control. It wasn't so bad. They were paying a tribute to Babylon, and the Jews didn't really see a necessity for return for Teshuvah. Yechezkel really gave them a hard time. He admonished them. The Jews who were in Babylon felt that Hashem had abandoned them somewhat, and that's why they'd been led off over there. And it was the fifth year of the Golus, in other words, 5 years after Yechezkel had been exiled to Babylon, that he was standing, some say, in the river of, it was a river called Kavar, Nahar Kavar, where he had his first prophecy. It was a very stern rebuke of the people. He really, if you have a look in your Yechezkel, he says some very scorning things and hard-hitting messages to the people, that they must return. This, of course, was before the actual Purim. The people scoffed at him. And it was in the 9th year of his captivity, on the 10th of Teves, that Yechezkel had his prophecy that the city was besieged. Which is interesting. This was before Reuters. Yechezkel ben Buzi was in Babylon. He had a prophecy on the 10th of Teves, and he told everybody, and he recorded it, that today the temple has been besieged. Of course, it was only later, I'm not sure how long later, that they found out that what he said was absolutely true to the day, and they believed in him as a Novi Emes, as a true prophet. And thereafter, after the destruction, Yechezkel turned from being a preacher to a counselor, one who is giving consolation. Of course, then the exiles came from Israel in their thousands. The community, which was already established in Babylon, welcomed them. Everybody felt distraught that the temple had been destroyed. They needed comforting. They were in a strange land, and it was Yechezkel that gave them that comfort. And here we have his beautiful vision of the Valley of the Dry Bones, the Atzomos Yevashos. Anybody who's read this prophecy is very moved by this prophecy of a valley of dry bones who come to life. They are resurrected. And Yechezkel was depicting over here the decimated nation of Israel being resurrected and eventually returning. He described in his prophecies in detail the New Jerusalem. And he said that the secret of redemption was only a true return to the Almighty. He said that the Almighty says, I delight not in the death of the wicked, said the Lord, but that he return from his evil way and live. Hashem doesn't want to kill the wicked, he wants them to repent. And the Jews felt, because of the prophecies of Yechezkel, a great burning desire one day to return. They didn't forget. They built there in Babylon Batei Knesiot and Batei Midrash. They built houses of learning, houses of study. Again, a number of members of nobility who were in the first captivity, who were carted out 11 years prior to the destruction, were four princes, four very important men. Their names were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were actually made servants in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. They were beautiful, they were good looking, they were clever. They refused to eat the tray for food in the palace. Nebuchadnezzar one evening went to sleep and he had a very strange dream. But when he woke up, he couldn't remember what it was. And he called all his advisors to come and tell him what was this dream. With great humility, Daniel comes to him and told Nebuchadnezzar exactly his dream and its interpretation. He told Nebuchadnezzar that he saw in his dream an image with a head of gold, and the other parts of the body were consisted of silver, brass, iron and clay. Then the image was suddenly struck by a stone and was destroyed, while the stone grew into a formidable mountain. And in fact, in the book of Daniel, there it is told at length, the explanation of this dream, which in fact depicted the destruction of the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, although he was told of his own destruction, was so impressed by Daniel that he appointed him to a very high position in his land. Shortly thereafter, there's a valley called the Dura Valley in Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar set up a huge effigy which he ordered all his people to worship. Everybody bowed down. Nobody was going to defy Nebuchadnezzar, except three: Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Well, four. Daniel didn't bow down to it either. But informers came and informed on the three of them, because they didn't want to say about Daniel, because he was a bit too close to the king for their liking. The king ordered that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah be thrown into a fiery furnace. And similar to the story of Abraham and Nimrod, when Abraham, as a young man, was cast into the fiery furnace in Ur Kasdim by Nimrod, similarly, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were cast into a fiery oven, and they did not burn. Miraculously, they were saved. Or not just saved, they walked about amongst the flames. It was so hot, the oven, it says that the people who threw them in died as a result of the heat of the flames, and yet they were unscathed. And this showed Nebuchadnezzar that he must not start up with these people. The book of Daniel tells about the other prophecies of Daniel, how he prophesied a horrible death and suffering for Nebuchadnezzar. He in fact turned towards, he became like an animal. He went insane towards the end of his life. And Nebuchadnezzar died in the year 336, for 26 years after the Churban. He was succeeded by Evil-Merodach, who was his son, and he released King Jehoiachin from prison after a 37-year stay in prison. He, in fact, released the Jewish king from prison. Evil-Merodach didn't reign for too long. He was succeeded by a king called Belshazzar. This was in the year 3387. Now, this, what I'm telling you now, is all foretold in the book of Daniel, but this particular part I'm sure you'll all know, and that is that we've all been talking about the Babylonian Empire till now. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar was a Babylonian and came and destroyed Israel, Babylon being Iraq, Mesopotamia. We must, however, at this stage of Jewish history, look further east. The Iraq-Iran war erupted. It's not a new war, because it happened then as well, because a new king arose in Iran, or what then was Paras, Persia, and his name was Koresh. Koresh came and marched westward. Belshazzar was having a banquet. He brought out the vessels of the temple to delight himself in his amazing kingdom. And suddenly a mysterious hand appeared and wrote some words on the wall. What were the words? Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. And of course he didn't know what they were. And Daniel came and interpreted them for him, that mene, mene, tekel, upharsin mean, your days have been numbered, your merits have been weighed and found wanting. Your kingdom shall be broken by the Persians. Upharsin, from the word paras, your kingdom will be broken by the Persians. And the prophecy, or the writing on the wall, was fulfilled that very night. So in fact, when somebody says, you've seen the writing on the wall, it in fact means an immediate thing. Because that very night, it was an amazing thing they did. They diverted the rivers of the Euphrates, and Koresh managed to get into the capital through, if you want, a back door, through a dry riverbed. And that very, very night, Belshazzar and his courtiers were murdered, and the Babylonian Empire collapsed, if you want, to be taken over by the Persian Empire. Daniel was kept as an advisor in the palace. The Jews now had to readjust to their new rulers. But this new king, Koresh, was a friend of the Jews. Not only was he a friend of the Jews, even more than that, within a year of his greatest triumph, which was the conquest of Babylon, Koresh issued the following edict. And he said like this: "Thus says Koresh, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up." Which means that Koresh did an amazing thing. He said that the Almighty had sent him to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And he said, whoever wants to go, go and I'll help you. Now this, of course, when as soon as he said that, you can imagine it was music to the ears of the people. There was so much excitement amongst the Jews in Babylon. They'd for long had this burning desire to go on Aliyah and not been able to. And now the king himself had said that the Almighty had sent him to do it. Led by a man called Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel, who was in fact of the princely house of David, and a high priest called Yehoshua Cohen Gadol, 42,360 people took Koresh on his word, up themselves from Babylon, and went and marched back to the land of Israel. An amazing point in history. I do not know if there's been another time in Jewish history where a king has said to the Jews, you can pick yourselves up and go back to your land, as there was then. Reallocation. We could sell our houses and take all our money with us and go and live in Israel. How many Anglo-Jews would pick themselves up and go? Of course, we've lived here longer than 60, 70 years, but the Jews in Babylon had resettled, and yet 42,000 of them picked themselves up and took the call and went back. What did they find when they arrived back in the land of Judah? Well, in the year 3390, 52 years after the destruction of the temple, they arrived back in Jerusalem under the leadership of this man called Zerubbabel. They found a destroyed land. They found a hurban. But they immediately set about in rebuilding it. In the month of Tishrei, they erected a mizbeach, an altar, and they brought sacrifices. They started work on rebuilding at least the foundations of the temple. Koresh, he gave permission for cedars to be shipped from the Lebanon all the way down the coast and to be transported to Jerusalem. Building materials were sent. Money was coming in. And in fact, the foundations for the second temple were laid by the people of Zerubbabel. However, do you remember I started off earlier by telling you that the northern kingdom of Israel had been exiled by a king called Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria? What I didn't tell you then was that when Shalmaneser, going back 100 years, had exiled the 10 northern tribes, he'd in fact brought other people in their place. These were people called the Kutim, the Kuthians, and they became to be known as the Shomronim, the Samaritans. These were people who, on the one hand, were pagan, and on the other hand, did have some Jewish practices. There is a great debate in the Talmud as to whether a Kuti is to be considered a Jew. For example, can we accept him as part of a minyan, and so on and so forth. In general, they were not part of the community. And when these Kutim saw that Zerubbabel and his people were being supplied and that they were in fact laying the foundations of the new temple, they felt, we want to be part of this. And they sent a delegation to Zerubbabel to ask him, come on, can we join on the bandwagon? And in fact, Zerubbabel sent a message back, thank you, but no thank you. And the Shomronim felt very insulted by this. In fact, they even resorted to physical attacks. And what they decided to in the end was to send a delegation to Koresh informing him that in fact the small yishuv in Israel now had different intentions. They weren't going to remain a tributary to your kingdom of Persia. No, as soon as they're strong enough, they will ally with somebody else, and they won't want to have anything to do with you. You better stop them building the temple. And that is exactly what happened. The king of Babylon sent an edict that the building was to be stopped. And of course, this dampened tremendously the spirits of the people. They'd come back all fired, all enthusiastic, and now the plot had been successful, the building had stopped. Let's have some fun. Till now, we've been talking about destruction and exile, but let's have some fun. Because at this junction in Jewish history is the story of Purim. We're 52 years after the destruction, after Belshazzar had fallen, Koresh had taken over. After Koresh, a king called Ahasuerus came on the scene. Now Ahasuerus was not of royal blood, and yet he ascended to the throne. But he decided to do a smart thing, and that was to marry somebody royal. He married the daughter of Belshazzar, who was called Vashti, and she happened also to be a granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So she was of royal blood, bad royal blood, may I add. But, and in fact that turned out in her personality, but Ahasuerus married her, and of course we all know the story, and he asked her to come and display herself. When she didn't, she was dispatched in the way of her forefathers, and there started the beauty contest, which we know who won it. A nice Jewish girl called Esther. One of the people, again, whom had been in the first captivity was Mordechai, and Mordechai was in fact descended from the tribe of Binyamin. Let me just tell you that the Megillah refers to him to Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ishimini. He is Mordechai the son of Yair, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Now Kish in fact was the father of Saul. So we skip a few generations over here, but the Megillah, or the story of Purim, which is recorded in the Scroll of Esther, traces the ancestry of Mordechai back to Saul. Of course, he was a Benjaminite. But why Saul? You have to understand over here that historically what was happening was that there was some unfinished business. Do you remember I told you that King Saul, the first king of Israel, had been instructed by God, by Samuel, to destroy all the Amalekites? He had done so, bar one. Who was that? The king of the Amalekites called Agag. And Samuel was very annoyed at Saul for leaving this Amalekite alive. And in fact, he reared children. He reared children whilst Agag reared children whilst in captivity before the prophet Samuel himself slew Agag. Haman, the wicked Haman, is referred to in the Megillah as Haman ha-Agogi, Haman the Agagite, because Haman was an Amalekite of the descent of Agag. And it was in fact Mordechai, who was descended from Saul. He had to finish off the unfinished business and to get rid of Haman. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole Purim story over here because it's a Langa Megillah. It's a long Megillah. But I'd like to point out, just take one verse in order to put things in a historical context. Do you remember that fateful evening when Esther requested to come to the king, and Haman was invited to the party, and they were all wondering, why, what are we doing here? And Ahasuerus says to Esther, Esther, ad chatzi hamalchus v'yinoseloch, I'll give you everything until half of the kingdom. Which half? What does it mean, half of the kingdom? The opening verse of the scroll is that Ahasuerus ruled from Hodu till Kush. Hodu is India, Kush is Ethiopia. Halfway between India and Ethiopia is Jerusalem. I will give you anything you ask, Esther, but don't ask me for one thing. Don't ask me to start rebuilding Jerusalem. You see, this was a request that was on Ahasuerus' mind. Jeremiah had prophesied that after a period of 70 years of exile, the Jews would return. Ahasuerus made a calculation that the 70 years had already finished, because he miscalculated. He calculated from the first captivity. He brought out the vessels of the temple in the famous feast that he made. Remember at the Megillah, he made a feast. Why did he make a feast? Because he felt, that's it. The Jews are here to stay. They're not going to go back. They're doomed. Their prophets have failed them. Their prophecies are to be ignored. And he made the feast. And the Jews came and they sat and enjoyed the feast. I'll give you everything, Esther, but don't ask me for Jerusalem. That I don't want to rebuild. And of course, you know the story. The final solution was leveled against the Jewish people. Miraculously, they were saved. We celebrate Purim today. And that story took place towards the end of the 70 years of exile in Babylon. Now, according to some opinions, Esther and Ahasuerus had a son. And this son was called Dariovesh, Darius. According to others, she didn't have a son. It's a question, who was Dariovesh? However, what is known is that in the, let's go back. I have to go back now. We finished the Purim story, yes? Let's just go back to what's happening in the land of Israel. In the land of Israel, everybody's very depressed. The building had stopped, and then had taken place the Purim story, and now the Jews were on top. Now the Jews were on top, and when the Jews were on top, Zerubbabel, the leader in Israel, felt this is a good time to go to Babylon and obtain permission from the new king, Dariovesh. Perhaps he will give permission to continue. Because the pioneers in Israel were very depressed. They'd come, they were all, as I said, excited, and now everything had stopped. So he made this journey to Paras, to Persia, and in fact obtained permission. The king gave him permission to continue with the building. His problem now wasn't permission from the king. His problem now was that when he returned to Israel, the people weren't interested anymore. The Jews said to him, oh, come on, we started building once, look what happened. So you've got permission from the king, so what? Hashem is angry with us. You saw what happened the first time? We picked ourselves up from Babylon, we came back, and we were stopped. And it was a crucial moment. The people, there was no inspiration. And as we've always said, at crucial moments in Jewish history, the Almighty sends his messengers to inspire us. At that moment, two prophets arrived on the scene, one called Haggai and one called Zechariah, both of whom have books in their names in the Bible. Haggai urged us to start the rebuilding. Zechariah had unbelievable visions of the rebuilding state, and there's a famous vision of Zechariah, how the menorah would look. I'll just read out to you one or two of the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai says to the people, "Who is left among you that saw this house in its former glory, and how do you see it now? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all you people of the land, saith the Lord, and work. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place I will give peace, saith the Lord of the hosts." In other words, this second house is going to be greater than the first house. Ladies and gentlemen, do you know how the second house was greater than the first house? The rabbis asked the question, what does this verse in Haggai mean? That the second house was greater than the first house. And according to one opinion, it was in the number of years that it stood. Because the first temple stood for 410 years, and the second temple stood for 420 years. So it stood for 10 more years. Right? 10 years more. Others say that in Binyan, the edifice of the second temple was more magnificent even than the first, particularly after it was renovated by a man called Hurdas, who we'll learn about next week. Zechariah came and said beautiful prophecies. I'll read out one verse from Zechariah to you because it is so moving. He was the prophet that said, "Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, said the Lord of hosts." In other words, your power, you people of Israel, is not with military strength. It is not with brute force. But it is your spirit, your ruchnius, your spiritual dimension, that is your great vantage point. These two prophets fired the people up again, and the building started. And it was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius, in the month of Adar, that the Mikdash was in fact completed, 70 years exactly after the destruction, fulfilling of course Jeremiah's prophecy that after 70 years the temple would be rebuilt. In that year, in the month of Nisan, Pesach was celebrated like never beforehand, and it was if a breath of fresh air had come to the people. And yet, strangely enough, we find that immediately after the temple had been rebuilt, things were still not quite right. The priests weren't doing their job properly. The Kohanim weren't doing their job properly. They were accepting blemished sacrifices. They weren't teaching the people the ways of God. And the Almighty sent a prophet called Malachi to admonish them and again also inspire them. The book of Malachi is a very interesting book. By the way, these prophets, Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi, are the last prophets of Israel. In fact, after they wrote down their prophecies, we'll learn about next week, please God, we'll learn about a body of men called the Men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah. They were the ones that took all these writings and formulated what we know as the Tanakh. But these people, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, were in fact the very last prophets of Israel who came and said, "Yes, we've had a prophecy from the Almighty telling you." And Malachi described how a Kohen should be, and also he describes the future as well. It's in fact in the book of Malachi that tells us that Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, will be the harbinger of the redemption. It's he who says that Elijah will come one day before the Mashiach will come and announce to us the coming of Mashiach. The source, in fact, for Eliyahu, Elijah being the harbinger of the redemption, is in the book of Malachi. So let's summarize. You've got the temple, the second temple, being rebuilt. the people slightly on a spiritual decline, Malachi fires them and he's admonished, he's trying to get sort things out, but the whole Yishuv is still iffy. The people, a lot of the people, had assimilated somewhat, and there was intermarriage. And here at this moment, there arrived on the scene a man who, literally, or two men, who reversed the situation and saved the situation. And these are the last two characters we'll speak about this evening. I'm sorry time's running on, but if I can have another few minutes. One was called Ezra. Ezra was a student of Baruch ben Neriah, who was a student of Jeremiah. Ezra carried the torch of tradition, the flame of tradition. He carried the learning which he'd received from Baruch ben Neriah, which he'd received from Jeremiah. Ezra, who lived in Babylon, was recognized by the king of Persia as a great scribe. In fact, when he requested the king after Baruch ben Neriah's death to go to Israel, the king allowed him with 1,500 people to go on Aliyah. The king liked him so much. He took with him much gold and silver and vessels. And he arrived in Israel in 3413, a year after the completion of the building of the second temple. So Ezra arrived in Israel 1 year after the rebuilding of the second temple. He arrived on Rosh Chodesh Av, and he found widespread assimilation, he found intermarriage. He immediately got the task of creating a new council, and his first task, interestingly enough, was to stand up and tell everybody, we must get rid of the women, the non-Jewish wives' influence among us. In other words, he stood up and told the people, you must get rid of your non-Jewish wives. The wives that you've taken from the surrounding nations, we need to marry Jewish. It's fascinating that Ezra stood up, and not only, do you know what happened? What happened was that he made this massive meeting in the temple. In fact, it took place on Chof Kislev, on the 20th of Kislev. We know the actual date, which is going to be this coming Sunday and Monday. And within 3 months, everybody had listened to Ezra's call. Can you imagine if the chief rabbi stood up today and said, okay, anybody who's married out, you know, dump them and marriage. Nobody. Who would listen? Right? It's not a blight on the chief rabbi, it's a blight on the community. Ezra stood up and said, we've got to clean our backyard up, we can't marry out. And that is what happened, an amazing thing. Ezra arranged a whole system of Levites to go to all the different villages to teach Torah. But he too was not saved from the hostility of the Shomronim, of the Samaritans. In fact, these Samaritans were openly hostile. And Ezra felt slightly set back by him. He needed an ally. And he found an ally in a man called Nehemiah ben Chaklaya. Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a royal cupbearer of King Artaxerxes. Difficult King to say, of Persia, and Nehemiah convinced then the king of Persia to allow him to go to Israel and to aid Ezra in rebuilding the Yishuv. The king agreed, he appointed Nehemiah as the governor, and he sent Nehemiah with a whole group of people to aid Ezra in Israel. As soon as Nehemiah arrived, he immediately set out rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. They were attacked physically by the Shomronim, by the Samaritans. However, Nehemiah and his men fought them off, and it took only 52 days until a wall was completed around Jerusalem to fortify it against the Samaritans. That was in the year 3426. Ezra and Nehemiah coupled up to raise the standards of the people. people that year came for Rosh Hashanah, and Ezra read to them from the Torah. He's referred to in the scriptures as Ezra HaSofer, Ezra the scribe. And he called the people to do teshuvah. In fact, his call on the day of Rosh Hashanah was so moving, everybody in the shul was crying out. And he had to say to them, don't cry out, today is the day of Rosh Hashanah. And in fact, he said to them, this day is holy to the Lord your God, don't mourn or weep, eat the fat and drink the sweet, and send portions to those who have nothing prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Don't distress yourselves, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. That, by the way, is the biblical source of eating a Yontif meal on Rosh Hashanah. One would have thought on the Day of Judgment one should perhaps not indulge. And yet the idea of eating meat and rejoicing comes from this verse in Ezra. On the 24th of Tishrei of that year, the people, if you want, re-established their covenant with God. And the Talmud equates Ezra to Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, in his influence on bringing the people into a covenant with God and re-establishing that covenant, the Talmud says that second to Moshe was Ezra. The revolution in his day was so powerful, and it was so influential that he really saved the day, Ezra together with Nehemiah. After 12 years of being there, Nehemiah was recalled by King Artaxerxes. He had business doing back in the palace. Nehemiah went away, the same thing happened, the Jews relapsed spiritually. Again, when Nehemiah heard, he begged the king to return the second time. And Nehemiah, when he came back to Jerusalem the second time, he really made it into a firm place. The gates of Jerusalem were closed on Shabbos. There was no traffic rolling down Rehov, whatever it was. It was really black. It was really from, or white, whichever way you want to look at it. The situation was black and white in that Jerusalem had become the citadel of Torah Judaism, and that in charge was Ezra and Nehemiah, and this is where we will close this evening. We started off with destruction, with fast days. We've gone out to Babylon. We've returned. We've had our stops and starts. But now, Judah has returned. I knew I had to say something which I forgot to say. Do you remember in the Megillah, Mordechai is called Mordechai HaYehudi? Now, which tribe did I say did Mordechai come from?
Benjamin.
It was a Benjaminite. So why is he called Mordechai HaYehudi? It doesn't mean from the tribe of Judah, because he was from the tribe of Benjamin. It means that he was from the remnants of the Jews. He came from Judea. And this is why we are called Jews. The first time the word Yehudi is used is Mordechai HaYehudi, is Mordechai the Jew, because he comes from that remnant of Judah. But the remnant that was now exiled has come back. So we're left at this stage of Jewish history. We'll close tonight with a small yishuv in Israel. The second temple has been rebuilt. Ezra and Nehemiah are on top, but there is still a community in Babylon. Next week, the period of the second temple.